Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the surge in Iraq, which is largely being reported as a success, both by the press and by the administration. And we'll get another insight into that from David Enders, who's a freelance journalist and the co-founder of Baghdad Bulletin, the first post-invasion attempt to set up an English-language news outlet in Iraq. And since the invasion, David Enders has spent more than 18 months in Iraq and has written for Men's Journal, Mother Jones, and The Nation, as well as the London Sunday Times and other newspapers. His first book, Baghdad Bulletin, was recently published by the University of Michigan Press, and David Enders has been blogging on his experiences in Iraq at the Pulitzer Center's website as part of their Iraq project. So I'll be looking into this new Sunni force called the Awakening Groups and the extent to which the United States may, in fact, be sowing the seeds of future conflict by arming and paying these new Sunni militias to the alarm of the Shiite government. And we'll talk with Joss Silver, who's the executive director of the Free Press, which was co-founded in 2002, to increase public involvement in the U.S. media and the telecommunications policy debates. Josh previously managed a successful campaign, finance ballot initiatives, and was the director of the Smithsonian Institution. Josh regularly publishes articles on media and internet policy and issues. He's a vigorous advocate for net neutrality and against further media consolidation, including last week's vote of 3-2 on the FCC panel, the Republican majority voting 3, the Democratic minority voting 2, allowing television newspaper ownership in the same media market. And, of course, this was done with the most bald-faced lie from Kevin Martin, the head of the FCC, who blandly and blithely said that by giving away more of the media to fewer and fewer moguls, that was adding to diversity. So I'll be looking into that Orwellian notion. And then we'll speak with Ian Williams, who's in London. He's a veteran journalist and author and UN correspondent for The Nation and The Tribune. He writes for Salon, Alternet, and Maxim's News. And he's also written a piece for The Guardian about the signs that the Serbs and their Russian backers are perhaps sowing the seeds for another round of a Kosovo war. We'll look into that. I'm now speaking with David Enders, who's a freelance journalist and the co-founder of the Baghdad Bulletin. Since the invasion, he spent more than 18 months in Iraq and written for various journals. And his first book, Baghdad Bulletin, was recently published for the University of Michigan Press. And David's been blogging on his experiences in Iraq at the Pulitzer Center's website. And David, there's been, perhaps it's premature celebrations here for the victory in Iraq. The administration and particularly the Republican House and Senate have made it very clear that the surge has worked, that the situation in Iraq is completely turned around, and by implication, the Democrats don't have Iraq as an issue in the 08 campaign. What's your sense, having spent some time there, of whether or not this is working?
Well, I think at various times during the war, obviously, we've been told that, this is a turning point, or we're winning, or things are working. Frequently, those campaigns to convince us that things are going well, or better than some people may perceive, are timed politically. For instance, the second invasion of Fallujah in 2004 was held off until after the presidential election. The initial invasion was April, and then a second go was postponed until after the election. this assertion that the surge is working, I think, is based on a number of things. Violence against U.S. troops in some parts of the country is definitely down, but that's because essentially troops have cut deals with most of the people they were fighting, which has caused an increased factionalism, more factionalism between Iraq's tribes. It's lent another facet to Iraq's multifaceted civil war. And I think people are just repositioning at the moment. The New York Times had articles today that I think laid it very bare, looking at these new basically tribal levies, these Sunni Arab tribal levies that the U.S. has begun supporting heavily in the last year, and how the Shiite-dominated, political Shiite Iraqi government essentially views these groups as a threat and then more or less a challenge. And some people are quite convinced that the overarching U.S. policy is simply to fund these groups as a counterbalance to very real and in some cases perceived Iranian influence in the government in Baghdad. There seemed to be a very slow learning curve as far as the administration was concerned that essentially it had leveraged into power, in theory, the very people it was trying to weaken by invading Iraq. Abdulaziz al-Hakim, who is essentially one of the more powerful U.S.-backed leaders in the country, is the head of the Supreme Iraqi Islamic Council, which is extremely close to Tehran. So ironically, in Iraq, Iran's closest enemies or closest allies in the country are also our closest allies or our government's closest allies. So obviously, there's a huge contradiction there, and many Iraqis just feel that the U.S. has kind of now figured out that they've empowered Iran by doing this, and now they're simply supporting essentially the old Ba'athists in some cases. One thing that the New York Times article today did a very good job of was explaining how essentially rehabilitated, members of Saddam Hussein's secret police are essentially leading some of these new neighborhood groups.
Well, let's talk a little about these awakening councils, which the U.S. is. This is the essential shift of what the surge really involved was. For some time, the Sunni have tried to approach the United States initially through the British. It took about a year for the Bush administration to get the message, but they basically said, "Look, we don't want to fight you guys. The real enemy are the Persians, the Shiites that you have stupidly empowered. So we'll have a truce with you. And then we'll go after al-Qaeda and clean up them. And then we're claiming victory based upon this tactical shift. I'm sure it's temporary on the part of the Sunni, but let's examine this, what we as taxpayers are now investing in, which is we're paying these guys $300 a month. There's about 78,000, soon to be 100,000 of them. How would you characterize these awakening councils?
Well, talking to foot soldiers, people are desperate for jobs. We went and visited, or I went and visited some of these villages in July with the U.S. military and was able to talk to some of these guys on the ground, and they indicated that they weren't joining for any love of the U.S. They were joining because they're, one, afraid of the Iraqi government and the militias it's perceived to support. They're afraid of Iran. They're afraid of the Iranian influence on the Iraqi government. They term Shiite militias like the Jaish al-Mehdi as Iranians, as non-Muslims. And one man said something that really stuck, and that was, well, we're fighting the bad al-Qaeda, not the good al-Qaeda. And essentially that means we're getting rid of the people who are kidnapping us or maybe killing us for noncompliance, but quite frankly, we still see the Americans as invaders. And this is nothing new. At various points in the war, you've seen the American military use the tool by one group against another. Right now you have a very vicious round of infighting within Muqtada al-Sadr's militia, which also probably has something to do with the quelling of some violence, is as these militias are occasionally in flux internally. They turn on one another and are fighting the U.S.
What's the result going to be if the Sunni that we're arming and paying, they basically refer to the Shiites as Persians or Shiite dogs. They refer to the militias. One of which, of course, is Sardis. If they're keeping their powder dry at the moment and trying to get some political concessions out of this Shiite government that seems incredibly intractable, isn't just a matter of time before we have another round in the Civil War?
Well, certainly. And you have, I mean, this is sort of finalizing one round. A lot of groups have also just taken over one neighborhood or another, either now directly with U.S. support, or because the U.S. can't do anything about it, or because the U.S. has tacitly allowed it to happen. So you have neighborhoods. Baghdad has essentially been cleansed along sectarian lines. Shiites have taken over some neighborhoods. Sunni guerrillas have taken over other neighborhoods. People have lost their houses. People have had property appropriated from them. There are somewhere around 4 million refugees inside and outside of the country. And so the U.S., what they've done is they've basically said, okay, these new divisions that have occurred, this massive movement of people, we're going to lock that in. We're going to say, okay, these groups that did this, now you can be in control of these neighborhoods, and in some cases we're going to support you. So I think that has a very obvious effect, and I think, you know, you're seeing that now. A lot of the blowback in 2006 was from movements of people caused by Saddam Hussein evicting people out of their houses, moving people into them. And a lot of the people who kicked people out of their houses in the last 2 or 3 years were people who lost their property in the 80s during similar purges of Shiites. So, right, it's just, you know, the pendulum is swinging one way, it will swing back. People have long memories.
So you don't think then, I mean, obviously, you know, the people at Fox News and the right-wing chattering people say that anybody that's critical of this war wants America to lose. So nobody has an investment in the notion that we've lost this war, even though it appears to be the case from day one. But on the other hand, if there is some credit to give the administration, then we should give them credit. But my feeling is that this is just a lull, and I don't see any way that the Shiite government is going to actually make the political concessions necessary. And it seems that in this lull, the Sunni are getting their act together, keeping their powder dry. But unless something dramatic happens, I can't see anything but round two in a really serious civil war. This time around, they'll really go after each other.
And the Shiites have been arming themselves as well. When we won't give them the weapons, they go to other places to find them. They're buying them from other countries. The FBI, a few months ago, 4 or 5 months ago, uncovered a huge shipment of arms from the Italian mafia to the Iraqi government. So if they can't get them from their U.S. backers, they'll go elsewhere. They see it coming as well. Mm. I mean, that's not the thing. When we're talking about this rhetoric, it's not just on the part of the Awakening Council, it's on the part of the Iraqi government. And I think a lot of U.S. commanders, if they think critically about this, they see it coming as well, however it's convenient for them not to be attacked. So
I'm just trying to pass through all this jingoism and propaganda and get down to the facts of whether or not this surge is working, whether or not this is just a pause, a calm before the storm. What's the end game here? What is Petraeus's end game?
Theoretically, to create political reconciliation. However, he's doing just the opposite. I mean, another thing in that New York Times article,
which is in Sunday's New York Times,
in today's
lead article,
paper, it's a long look at the Awakening Councils, interviews with a lot of Awakening Council members, and the same kind of stuff I heard when I was doing that.
The headline is the Awakening Councils a force for Iraqi calm or the seeds of conflict? And that's essentially the questions we're asking here.
Right, and one of the generals says, we're not trying to create two parallel governments. And in essence, that's exactly what's happening. And this is, you know, the U.S. military at times will say things that sound the opposite of what is true, and this is one of those cases. We're not trying to create two parallel governments, but that is what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the U.S. is still largely funding these. And even if you go inside the Iraqi government, I mean, that there have been some great stories about how divided and factionalized the Iraqi government itself is. You just have a country that looks increasingly like Afghanistan,
but
everything is a patronage system.
Right. But it seems to me, David, that the Iranian-backed Shiite militias and their representatives in this largely Shiite government basically haven't had any interest in fighting. There was that brief moment where Saada's militias were fighting the Marines, but since then they have basically avoided any conflict. And I'm trying to figure out at what would tip them over the edge if they, in fact, you know.
Well, that's not true.
I mean, let's face it.
You see that a lot less, but yeah. It happens quite frequently. I mean.
Right.
There are a number of engagements between elements of Saada's militia and the U.S. military. They have been keeping it much lower key than at a time when you had sort of a widespread uprising in 2004. But there is quite a bit of fighting. But for the most part, the U.S. just tolerates them, is what's happening. I mean, the U.S. is going after some of those leaders to some extent. There have been a much greater number of arrests.
But let's face it, the Sunni, and particularly the Al-Qaeda elements, their strategy was to enact hideous attacks and run up, you know, indiscriminate casualties, along with blowing up holy shrines, in the hope that they'd provoke the Shiites into a full-scale war. That seems to have been their tactic, right? That hasn't worked. So what is restraining them, and what situation could come about would go away? That's my question.
As far as with the Shiites?
Yeah. In other words, if you're predicting that this thing's not going to work, and that eventually the Awakening Councils and the Shiite militias are going to go toe to toe, what's restraining the Shiites at this moment?
To some extent, the U.S. military. But I mean, this is, we're talking about the U.S. military having built walls around neighborhoods, and really, I mean, and in some cases, nothing really has. The sort of end of this round of sectarian cleansing occurred in Baghdad after the surge had begun. And a lot of it happened over the last year, and especially that first 6 months where the troops were there. So I wouldn't say that the surge has necessarily stopped that. In some places, it has literally prevented it by building walls around entire neighborhoods and then supporting the Sunni militias inside these walls. I don't think the Shiite resolve to wipe Baghdad clean is actually gone. I think they're biding their time as well. And I think Al-Qaeda is not exactly... I think that when you say Al-Qaeda, that was kind of the larger Sunni Arab insurgent strategy. I mean, the Ba'ath Party was never adverse to destroying Shiite shrines in order to assert its power.
Was that their motive, to assert power, or to hope to provoke them into a broader conflict?
Well, I think there were some people who were trying to do that, and I think that... But I think just saying that it's Al-Qaeda, that Al-Qaeda was the only group who was trying to provoke that wider conflict, I think that was the wider sort of Sunni Arab, Ba'athist, Saddamist, in some cases nationalist strategy. They just saw themselves as being a much larger force than they were. I mean, for the first 2 or 3 years, you'd hear Sunni Arabs saying things like, we're 50% of the population, things that were just statistically wrong. And a lot of, I think, the initial resistance to the occupation was predicated on a belief in Iraq that didn't necessarily exist. And so I think a lot of what happened was you just had not the Shiite resolve weaken per se. I don't think it's gone down much after 2006, when things really kind of broke loose. I think the Sunnis just, for the most part, finally made a pragmatic decision to stop fighting on two fronts. And the Shiites are pausing based on that. I don't think the violence between the two sides has died down all that considerably. I think it's just, you know, it's reshaping.
Mm-hmm. So just in closing then, and by the way, a correction here, you've spent 2 years out of the last 4 years in Iraq, right?
Yeah, about that.
And you're heading back?
Probably next summer, yeah.
I see. So what would your prediction be then in the face of all of this premature elation, if you will, on the part of the administration and the Republican leaders, particularly the Senate leader and others? Their sense is that they've really taken the Iraq issue off the table in the 08 elections. And so what's your feeling about what's likely to happen in the next few months?
It depends on how long the U.S. keeps up this support. And I mean, it's really hard to make predictions in Iraq. I think it's easier to say, well, I don't think this person's prediction is correct based on X, Y, Z. I mean, as far as prognosticating myself, I've tried to avoid that, whereas, you know, I think it's much easier to be on rational ground and say, okay, here are the reasons it's not safer. Mm. I mean, in 2006, there were far more neighborhoods I could move freely in than in 2007. I mean, simple fact, the city is more walled off from itself than it was. People move less than they did a year ago. More areas are controlled directly by militias than a year ago.
Could that settle into a de facto petition? We've also got the Kurds.
Well, I think that's more or less what's happened. Right. You have flashpoints like Kirkuk, which just in this last week, and I think it was probably obvious to most people this was going to happen, they delayed the referendum on whether or not it'll become a part of Kurdistan because of the violence occurring around this issue. Mm. And the fear of worse violence when presumably the Kurds inevitably win the vote, either because they've been moving lots of people into Kirkuk to pack the vote, or because they'll just simply commit outright fraud, is what most people believe. I mean, both sides have said that they're not going to let that issue go, that if they don't win at the ballot, they'll fight. So that's another thing. That's off the American radar for the most part. That's out of the discourse. And then this whole issue with Turkey, occasionally now bombing and doing overflights in the north with the PKK and the U.S. very openly. It's just...
So I get
all of these issues that point to years of instability and you know, a weaker state than currently exists.
Well, let me just in closing try and summarize. Your suggestion is that even though the surge has provided an appearance of calm, that arming the Awakening Councils has its consequences. The Shiites are certainly they're continuing to arm. Both sides are sort of keeping their powder dry. There's a kind of lull going on here. Obviously, on the part of the administration, there's a hope that this will last through the election cycle, so that they can maintain success. So, but just in the end of the day, you're not buying it. But you
well, no. I mean, if you look at like what's one of Iraq's major problems, unemployment. How are we solving this problem? We're paying people $300 a month to pick up a gun. We're not creating any new jobs per se. We're just giving people money to arm themselves. That's the opposite of what the country needs. When you have most Iraqis will tell you the reason so many young men have joined the insurgency is either because of, you know, dissatisfaction with the occupation or you know, the U.S. military itself says so many people are joining the insurgency because they need money. They're not doing it because of ideology. They're doing it because Al-Qaeda pays you. This is a common thing that you hear from U.S. soldiers. So, okay, we're just going to pay them instead.
Right.
What are these guys, you know, you can go back, a lot of people have been using the Afghanistan analogy. Arm the Mujahideen, eventually it blows back. No surprise.
Well, I thank you, David. I mean, it's always good to talk to you.
I apologize for not being more optimistic.
No, it's important to be realistic, but, you know, to give credit where it's due and criticism where it's appropriate. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with David Enders, who's a freelance journalist and the co-founder of the Baghdad Bulletin. He spent two out of the last 4 years in Iraq, and he blogs in Iraq at the Pulitzer Center's website, part of their Iraq project. I'm now speaking with Josh Silver, who's the executive director of the Free Press, which was co-founded in 2002 to increase public involvement in U.S. media and telecommunications policies debates. And Josh has previously managed successful campaign finance initiative, ballot initiatives, and was a director at the Smithsonian Institution. He regularly publishes articles on media and internet policy issues. He's a vigorous advocate for net neutrality. And, of course, this last week, the FCC voted 3-2 with the Republican majority 3, the Democratic minority 2, allowing television newspaper ownerships to merge in, or to allow for cross ownership in the same media markets, and meaning the 20 leading media markets in this country. And his work's available at the Free Press website, www.freepress.net. So, Josh, I must say that when Kevin Martin announced this 3-2 victory, if you will, for the Republicans on the FCC, I couldn't believe how brazen the Orwellian logic was. He was saying that by giving more and more of the media spectrum to fewer and fewer moguls, he was striking a blow for diversity.
It was Orwellian indeed. I mean, what happened last week at the Federal Communications Commission, which, as you mentioned, you know, the vote happened on partisan lines, a 3-2 vote, very controversial. The FCC had been hauled up in front of Congress twice in the past 2 weeks by both the House and Senate. Senators from both parties, even far right-wing conservatives like Trent Lott in the Senate, along with Ted Stevens and Olympia Snow, rebuked him, said, wait, said, this is not the right thing to do. And if you recall, this goes all the way back to 2003, when a similar effort was made by the previous FCC chairman. Really, what's happening, I think, is directly related to what's happening in Los Angeles right now. If you'll notice, yesterday the announcement came that Sam Zell, a real estate mogul, finally got a hold of the Tribune Company and the LA Times. And what we're seeing is this consolidation does nothing good for the media, for diversity, for promoting independent voices or critical journalism. It only fattens the bottom line for the largest corporations. And so the logic that Kevin Martin is using is completely flawed on every front.
So what happened here with the Tribune going private with this fellow who's a specialist in distressed properties, kind of a rag and bone man in the Cockney tradition? But here he is, basically getting taking it private through the pension funds, I guess, of the employees, but injecting $300 million, I think, of his own money, and to get a multi-billion-dollar company. It seems extraordinary, taking on a lot of debt. But what's the relationship between the FCC decisions? Didn't they give him a kind of waiver to go ahead with this deal? Because he's the first out of the gate to make to do what they've allowed, right?
Yeah, I mean, this deal that Kevin Martin at the FCC allowed, it was specifically for Sam Zell and the Tribune Company buyout, and also two other main companies, Gannett Newspapers, a massive newspaper chain, and the all-too-famous Rupert Murdoch and News Corporation. All three companies needed this blessing from the chairman, but you're right, they did in a very corrupt manner, gave the so-called waivers allowing this to happen a few weeks ago. But let's back up. I mean, what we're talking about here is a U.S. media system that's already extremely consolidated. In the last 30 years, you've seen a loss of one-third of independent TV owners, one-quarter of independent radio owners, and a full two-thirds of independent newspaper owners have been bought out by conglomerates in the last 30 years. We are seeing a very clear, direct correlation between the consolidation of media ownership and this unquenchable thirst for profits that you're seeing at media properties. Kevin Martin at the FCC really, at the end of the day, justified the rule change, as I said, so controversial, based on the need to bail out a flailing and failing newspaper industry. That sentiment was actually echoed in the LA Times write-up itself this week about the Sam Zell buyout of the paper, when they actually referred to the revolutionary decline in newspapers and how they're losing readers in droves. Actually, if you fact-check that, you find out that newspapers, which once used to turn 30% and even higher profits, huge, huge profits, are now down to about 17-18% per year on average, And that profit rate is still higher than just about every single Fortune 500 company. So while newspapers are suffering as a result of the internet and things like Craigslist, we're still seeing massive profits. What really concerns me is if you look at the fine print in the buyout of the LA Times, you'll see that this guy, Sam Zell, needs to pay off $1 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars per year just to make interest payments on the acquisition of these properties. So what you see when owners like Sam Zell, who said he's into this deal for nothing but economic reasons, economic gain, he's not in it for promoting democracy or the dissemination of news and information and critical journalism in Los Angeles, is you're going to see cuts in newsroom staff, you're going to see increases in advertising, and you're going to see the commercialization of the LA Times and all the other properties owned by Tribune.
Well, but that's already happened. Well, I mean, the paper has fired a ton of people, and it's more and more weighed down with ads.
Yeah, and it's only going to get worse. I mean, what's really, really alarming about this whole story, about what happened at the FCC this week and what's happening at the LA Times this week, is that when the Federal Communications Commission moved many months ago, really over a year ago, to start loosening media ownership caps, for the second time, they were pushed back in 2003 when a court actually reversed a ruling, a vote that was made at the FCC in June of 2003. They went out across the country under congressional pressure to hold six public hearings so that the public could ostensibly tell the FCC what they wanted and the FCC could act accordingly. We actually did the research on those hearings, and a full 99% of the public 99% of the people who testified to the FCC at these hearings over the past year said they do not want further media consolidation. So the only answer, the short answer to your original query is, what happened this week is pure corruption. It's pure Washington politics where if you pay, you get to play and everyone else gets no voice.
Well, this was a fine tradition started by Kevin Martin's predecessor, Colin Powell's son. I mean, he was flying around in Warner Brothers jet. I mean, he couldn't give enough away too, right? I mean, what motivates these guys? Are you thinking it's just that they want to rub shoulders with the powerful, or?
Oh no, it's uglier than that. What you have is you've got folks like Rupert Murdoch and you've got Tribune and Gannett and other major media conglomerates that have been greasing the wheels for the White House, the Bush White House, for many, many years. And not just greasing the wheels financially, although they do donate more money and lobby the Hill harder than just about any industry in the country, but they also provide favorable coverage. I mean, let's be frank. The major mainstream media fell down on the job in the run-up to the war in Iraq and on so many of the president's policies in a sort of a quid pro quo that increasingly exists as media consolidates, which is they're easy on government, and government, in turn, hands out the kind of policy favors that they did this week. You mentioned 2003. Michael Powell, the son of the former Secretary of State, he moved to relax a whole plethora of ownership rules, four major rules. This last week was just one. And he was rebuked not only by the left, but he was rebuked by the same senators I mentioned earlier, as well as the National Rifle Association, the right-wing Parents Television Council, headed by Brent Bozell, and a whole list of others. So, you know, what we're finding is that, you know, in many ways, what happened with Kevin Martin this week, and remember, the chairman of the FCC is a Bush operative. He was one of the ballot counters in Florida in 2000. His wife was a senior staffer for Dick Cheney for many years. This is sort of a last 11th-hour gasp by one of the most corrupt administrations that this country's ever seen, to pay back favors to the biggest media companies, and they just got away with it.
And specifically then, so what happens here with these big companies like Viacom and News Corp is that they have all kinds of interests. They make a lot of money available to the administration and to their candidates. But the quid pro quo is we give you good coverage, you give us deregulation, I mean, there's some specifics here, because I understand that when, for example, when the administration shut down Dan Rather's story, which he still insists is for real, and he's suing CBS, I think, for $70 million about Bush's National Guard record, the 60 Minutes show that blew up in their face, at that time, I understand that the White House put pressure on Sumner Redstone, threatening something like $400 million in tax breaks he had. So is that how the game is played, that these big corporations get not just deregulation, but they also get tax breaks?
No, yeah, across the board. They get, you know, remember, broadcast licenses are free, and they are dealt out literally using the FCC issues a postcard that renews those licenses, which in the old days the stations actually had to prove that they were serving the public interest in covering local news issues and deserving of these free broadcast licenses, which bring them enormous profits. If you look at, you know, you mentioned Sumner Redstone. He gave an infamous speech about 2 years ago in Hong Kong. It was actually 3 years ago, just before the last presidential re-election of Bush. And he said, you know, I've been a lifelong Democrat, but President Bush is better for Viacom, so I'm supporting President Bush. And that's what you're seeing when you see the consolidation of these papers. The FCC's own data shows that when things happen like cross-ownership, when newspapers buy up TV and radio stations, as the FCC allowed this week, that there is a sum total decrease in local news coverage in the markets that the cross-ownership occurs in. So, you know, what we're finding, though, is that there is a silver lining. And the silver lining is that back in 2003, when the former FCC commissioner tried to lift these rules, around 3 million people said no. It was staggering, and frankly, it was unexpected from the left and the right. And as I mentioned, you know, there was an act of Congress to overturn it. Of course, the president didn't sign it, and the courts eventually rolled it back. But we're seeing the same kind of backlash happening now with this issue. And we're seeing you know, hundreds of thousands of people have gone to StopBigMedia.com. A similar coalition has come together. We're looking at action in the Congress, either in the form of a seldom-used resolution of disapproval or legislation itself. There's going to be major appeals filed in the federal courts, and so there's going to be many fronts where we're going to try to push these back, and I think if there's enough public will, we'll be successful.
And, of course, the other thing we have to keep our eye on is that as the newspapers and the television from which most people get their information, as they become more and more consolidated hands of fewer and fewer moguls, their product becomes more and more bland and inoffensive, and infotainment merges. You can see that, for example, you know, Dancing on with the Stars is ABC's hit, but then you immediately the 11 o'clock news that follows Dancing with the Stars, its lead story is Dancing with the Stars. I mean, it's that old vertical integration thing, but it's all been done at the expense of dumbing down the American public. What is saving us from political being politically brain dead in this country is the internet, and yet the same moguls that are getting this giveaway from the FCC, they also want to control the media, and that's what this net neutrality battle's about.
Yeah, I'm glad you mention it. Yeah, and you know, you laugh, and it would be funny if what's happening with the dumbing down of journalism wasn't happening at the expense of participatory democracy itself. We are seeing a sharp increase in the use of internet. We're hovering around 50% of American homes have high speed broadband. That's going up not nearly as fast as other countries. You know, just to
South Korea has universal broadband, and their economy is just humming. I mean, it's absolutely criminal the way the United States has the last mile has been held up, because all that fiber optics is laid. There's no reason why we don't have universal broadband, but for the greed of these big moguls.
That's right, and yet, you know, we've seen also since 2000 the United States has slipped from fifth in the world in broadband penetration to 16th. All the while, when Bush initially was running for office, he actually made the claim that by 2007 every American home should have broadband, and that he would make sure that happened. We're far from it, halfway. But really, answering your question about net neutrality and the future of internet, you couldn't be more correct. I mean, the reality is, and everyone should pause and listen because this is big, computers and televisions are merging. And people need to understand that, that in just a few years, virtually all televisions will be getting their signal through high-speed broadband. Gone will be the old system, the old analog connections. This has been mandated by Congress. And so what we're looking at is if internet is going to become your primary means for delivering radio and television, and it is, then the policies that decide how much broadband costs and how accessible it is become profoundly important. What's happening right now, the debate over net neutrality, is simply this. Phone and cable companies control 98% of the broadband market in this country. You generally don't have a choice beyond one or the other or both. They are trying to set up legislation so that they can set up toll booths and say, Google or WABC, if you pay me extra money, your sites will download really fast. And those of you who can't afford to pay extra, your sites will download slow. This is a profound decision that ultimately will determine whether or not the internet continues to be neutral and ubiquitous and an equal playing field for everybody, or if it will become more like cable TV, where the cable and phone companies decide how much it costs, what you get to see, and who gets to see it.
Well, just in closing, then, there are two issues we haven't had time to cover. And that, I mean, one is, of course, the just to put this further in the context of how fewer and fewer people ending up with more and more media power. The ultimate irony is in this political year we're heading into now, 2008, with the front-loaded primaries, we will know early who the candidates are, and then the entire summer the battle will be fought out on television. And this is true of all political campaigns and all politicians. They raise money from special interests in order to turn that money over to media moguls, because 90% of what they raise goes to buy television. So politics has been captured by the same people that Kevin Martin just gave the store away to. And that's why we have incredibly bad politics in this country, because it's an incestuous arrangement between politicians, special interests, and in the end of the day, the people who are really rewarded are these media moguls.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what's happening is you should be on the show with me next time I'm talking about these issues, because the fact is thousands of Americans are starting to understand this, and that's why you've seen since 2003 the birth of a bona fide media reform movement. People have realized that regardless of what my primary issue is, whether it's taking care of the environment or health care or civil rights or whatever, we're not getting anywhere if the media continues to consolidate and we lose the hope of the internet and we lose these crucial issues and people can't actually learn about what's really happening in the world. You know, I should mention this net neutrality fight. It was amazing to see 1.6 million Americans piped up and said no. Last year, we managed to kill an entire Republican-sponsored bill in a Republican Congress and White House that would have really killed the internet as we know it. So this movement really is percolating. People went to savetheinternet.com and did that on this ownership issue. They've been going to stopbigmedia.com. And I think there's reason for hope. There is really a changing tide in this country where people are starting to understand that we have to reclaim our media if we're going to reclaim any issue we care about.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Josh Silver.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Josh Silver, who's the Executive Director of the Free Press there at www.freepress.net. I'm speaking now with Ian Williams, who's in London. He's a veteran journalist and author who is the United Nations correspondent for The Nation and The Tribune. He writes for Salon, Alternet, and Maxim's News. You have a piece, Ian, in The Guardian about Serbia's self-defeating posture in terms of the United Nations not being able to come to an agreement over what to do about Kosovo, Russia backing Serbia, the United States and the European Union backing Kosovo. Do you think that this thing could spin out of control and we can have another round of a Balkan war?
No, I mean, that's one of the points. The article didn't talk about Serbian posture. It talked about Serbian posturing. Polls show that most Serbs have no sort of know that there's no hope whatsoever of regaining Kosovo. So the issue is really a sort of symbolic one. And what's sort of amazing is the complete absence of any sort of, how should we say, you know, apology or sense of contrition over what Milosevic did to the Kosovars. I mean, they still basically feel that the Kosovars don't have any say in their own future. It's part of Serbia whether the vast majority of the population there like it or not. And the vast majority of the population there obviously don't like it since they were forced out of Bane of Points back in 1999. So there's no way in any realistic set of circumstances that Serbia will ever regain control of Kosovo. And by sort of by this posturing, they're making it difficult to get the type of resolution which would in fact ensure the safety of the remaining Serbs in Kosovo and would ensure smooth relations. Because, look, in the end, I mean, if all of these countries join the European Union, then they may as well, it's almost as if the former Yugoslavia had been reconstructed. You know, you've got free transit across the borders, you'd have a single currency, you'd have free mobility for people to move from one country to another for education, health, or work. So it really is about posturing, nationalist posturing.
Well, when you say that the Serbians have a self-defeating posture and that they haven't come to terms with what Milosevic did in Kosovo, they haven't come to terms with what Milosevic did to Yugoslavia itself and particularly to Serbia, because essentially what happened in that war was the Milosevic stole the treasury, parked it in Cyprus. And then, because he couldn't get the army to fight, he then opened the jails, created these gangster militias, and they went and caused incredible mayhem. And then, eventually, the U.S. secretly armed these Croats, and then they turned around and kicked the Serbs out. And then the Serbs ended up having more refugees than even the Bosnians and Croats. And it's this whole exercise of allowing a country to be taken over by criminals. The Serbian people have paid the greatest price, but they seem to be in such denial because of all this nationalistic fervor. So.
What I think you and I both find equally intriguing is it's not just the Serbs who are in self-denial, it's all the American so-called leftists who see Milosevic, who is, you know, a sort of kleptocrat of the first order, who looted the treasury and whose family privatized all of the Yugoslav state industries and looted them and, as you said, took the proceeds abroad to Cyprus. And he is presented by otherwise revered leftists here in the States as a great champion of socialism against Western imperialism.
Well, that was the narrative during the American intervention. But I mean, which part of the left are we talking about? I mean, so I guess the argument was over between people who were against ethnic cleansing and then those who thought that the anti-imperialists, right? That's that. But do these?
Well, there were people who just denied that they have their fixed set of goodies and baddies, and the goodies don't do things, so they just ignored the ethnic cleansing. And I mean, if you go onto any website now, you will hear people say that the refugees from Kosovo left as a result of NATO bombing, which is, you know, just an absolute lie. They were already being sent out of Bane of Points. There were all refugee camps in Albania and Macedonia already before. That was why the NATO actually had to intervene.
So do they feel the same way about Rwanda?
Rwanda, they could. I don't think they could see which. Because the U.S. wasn't involved, they couldn't give a damn either way.
Right, but that was ethnic cleansing that could have been stopped by, you know, maybe as few as 100 soldiers. But
Madeleine Albright and the Presidential Directive 35 under President Clinton.
Ian, just before we get off this tangent here, you're not talking about anybody but the kind of far left.
Well, actually, I mean, one of the disturbing things is these people are so strident and certain in their lives that you find this sort of percolates through, and there's a sort of in places where one would expect to see better, you see that there's a sort of moral equivalence between sort of Milosevic and the Kosovars that sprung up, and, you know, the Serbs are really suffering now, why doesn't anyone talk about them? Well, in fact, lots of people are talking about what happened to the Serbs, but not very few talking about what happened to the to Milosevic's victims in the other republics.
Well, let's talk about the people who really have some clout in this, and who are have the same mindset, albeit from a different vector, and that is the Russians. They're the ones that are supporting Serbia's obdurance. And what's their motive? I mean, what?
Well, there's a mixture of motives. First of all, you know, Russia has a sort of a genuine concern about precedence because of Chechnya and all of the sort of, you know, the sort of Rube Goldberg construction of autonomous republics and regions. They don't want to see the Kosovo as a precedent for that. So there's some legitimate deal, and the Americans and Europeans and others have said, well, look, this is a one-off. This is special circumstances. Think of Bangladesh. So, you know, that's the one angle. The second one, of course, is that basically the Russians are extremely annoyed with the fact that for 15 years since the fall of the wall and the Warsaw Pact, Washington has been rubbing their nose in the dirt and hasn't been treating, you know, they've been disrespecting them. So what the Russians have when the Russians use a veto, it's often just to remind Washington that they do have this power. And, you know, I think that adroit diplomacy and serious talking and horse trading with them on issues might produce results.
Did you say diplomacy?
Well, I know it's an oxymoron, Bush diplomacy.
We don't do no diplomacy.
No. That's been the big problem, hasn't it? But and then finally, there is this sort of Serb Orthodox mystic bit, which, I mean, I think it's a shame. Certainly at the time of the events in Kosovo, the Russian ambassador to the UN told me privately that he thought that what Milosevic was doing there was insupportable, but he wasn't happy with the Western response. And even then, you remember, it was Clinton who refused to go to the Security Council because he assumed, with some degree of justice, that the Russians would veto it there. But he, once again, diplomacy might have got something there. Look, you know, we're taking this very, very seriously, and we're going to go ahead anyway. So if you veto it, it will just be humiliating and show up your veto. You abstain on this one and let us settle him, because if you can't persuade him.
So what's going to be the solution here? Because the diplomacy hasn't worked at the Security Council's deadlocked, and so what's the next step?
Well, the next step, you're going to get a sort of Taiwan Plus situation, I suppose, or like Bangladesh. First of all, almost certainly every country, or almost every country in Europe and NATO, is going to recognize an independent Kosovo. And it's funny, I mean, one of the points about the posturing of the Serbs is that they say they will withdraw recognition of any country. This is what some of them have been threatening. We withdraw recognition of any country that recognizes Kosovo. Well, if Serbia wants to withdraw recognition with all of its surrounding trading partners, the people who have just offered it a few billion dollars in accession euros, in accession funds, then they can go ahead and do so. But I don't think that then such a government would last very long in Belgrade, since, you know, the Serbian electorate can only put it with a certain amount of disconnect from reality on the part of their rulers.
Well, they've got a ruler who is a little disconnected from reality. The original ruler was assassinated by thugs, and he was more pro-Western.
Look, and we've got to be careful about these terms like pro-Western, which are used by people we've been discussing. You know, being pro-democratic does not mean pro-Western.
Right.
Being in support of human rights does not mean pro-Western.
Well, but Gingrich was
about these labels.
Right, but Gingrich was better than his successor, wasn't he? The guy that was killed.
Certainly, yes. There's no doubt, and that's why he was assassinated. And Kostunica and the others are that they're equally as, in fact, in many ways, they're more sincere nationalists than Milosevic, because Milosevic wasn't a real nationalist. He was an expedient nationalist.
Hmm.
I mean, he used Serb nationalism to get power, first of all in Serbia, and then he hoped throughout the whole of Yugoslavia. And when that was foiled, he wanted to create a greater Serbia with him in charge.
Right,
but it was all about him getting power. I mean,
yeah, him and his Lady Macbeth wife, right?
Yes, I mean, he was quite happy at cutting deals with his former sort of Communist Party colleague, comrade Tudjman, in Croatia. They were of the same ilk. They could do business.
Well, it's we thought this agony was over. It doesn't sound like it'll be revisited, but it's still something to keep our eye on. I thank you for joining us here in Los Angeles from London, Ian Williams.
Thanks, Ian. And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year and all the rest of it to everyone.
Thank you. Bye bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Ian Williams, who's in London. He's a veteran journalist and author who is the United Nations correspondent for The Nation and The Tribune, and who had an opinion piece in The Guardian, Serbia's self-defeating posture. This program is produced by Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, and Luke Duana. The assistant producers, Melissa Figueroa, is the engineer.